You're listening to The Gold Standard, Episode 26, Michael Moore, The Making of an Artist.
Everybody, I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation, once again bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If film, books, dance, music, poetry, visual art, theater, novels, or design are the wake-up call you need to stay engaged and active in tough times like these, you have come to the right place, my friends. But first, while you're stopping by under our celebrated neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you just so happen to be listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. And to get more scintillating sounds, words, and images, we'd love you to pay us a visit at our website, glenngould.ca. While you're there, you'll undoubtedly notice a donate button, and we are, in fact, a registered Canadian charity. We rely on the generosity of listeners like you to continue our work, so please do give generously. Today, our guest is somebody whose work arouses many responses, but indifference is certainly not one of them. He is credited with revolutionizing the documentary film form, but has also been prolific as a writer, TV personality, humorist, journalist and editor, a radio host and commentator, and also in theater. And with the advent of the COVID pandemic, he's become a hugely successful podcaster. I'm speaking, of course, about Michael Moore, who rocketed to international prominence in 1989 with his first film, Roger and Me, which showed the devastation caused by the General Motors plant closures in his hometown of Flint, Michigan. He has gone on to direct a dozen films, including Fahrenheit 9/11, Fahrenheit 11/9, Sicko, Bowling for Columbine, Capitalism, A Love Story, and Where to Invade Next. Bowling for Columbine, an examination of American gun culture, won an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature and the Cannes 55th Anniversary Prize, and became the highest-grossing documentary film of all time. That is, until it was overtaken by his next film, Fahrenheit 9/11, an excoriating look at the presidency of George W. Bush and the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, which went on to win the Palme d'Or at Cannes. He has written 8 best-selling books, created and hosted the successful TV shows The Awful Truth and TV Nation, and even had a one-man show on Broadway. Michael has been a prominent progressive social and media critic and has earned a huge social media following. He made news again with his migration to a new online platform, Substack, part of a new wave of content creators moving away from the dominant online services. Michael, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Let me ask you a question to begin with. The reference to, this is called the Gould Chronicles, right?
Standard. Gould Standard, as in Gold Standard.
Oh, okay, yes, because it's a play off the... So Glenn Gould... This is, I assume this is named in his honor. And
it is.
And he is, as I know it, one of the top 5 most beloved Canadians after Wayne Gretzky, your first prime minister, MacDonald.
Not so much MacDonald anymore. He's under a cloud.
Oh, really?
He was one of the architects of the residential school system.
Oh, that. Oh, brother. Okay. He's off the list. Replace him with Tim Horton. All right.
And Tommy Douglas.
And of course, Tommy, you're, yes, I was getting there. Tommy Douglas, I remember when I made Sicko, they had just conducted a poll. I don't know if it was the CBC or whatever, but who is your most admired Canadian of all time? And Tommy Douglas was at the top of the list, and it's not because he was Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather.
Right, exactly.
That's the only way I can explain him to Americans, because no, I swear to God, no American knows who Tommy Douglas is. And I would give $100, like if you wanted to do a call-in right now, let's just go through any phone book in the United States, call them up, ask them who Tommy Douglas is. And of course, I would think those those in power here probably would not want to hear the story of Tommy Douglas, because if we ever get our act together, you know, I've stopped calling it socialized medicine, Medicare for all, any of that. I just say I want what the Canadians have. That's it.
Yeah.
Just give me whatever they got. Yeah, that's what I want. Canadian care. Yeah, but no, it's really actually goes over quite well, because, you know, most Americans, though they know little of Canada, they do have a good feeling when they hear the word. And it's not a negative word. If I say I want Canadian care, oh, well, what is that? Well, here's what it is. Whenever you get sick, you get to go to the doctor. And if you forget your wallet at home, it's okay, because they're not going to ask you to pull out your wallet. And you're not going to lose your home, by the way, in some foreclosure because you couldn't pay the hospital bill. So they hear that and they go, well, that sounds damn good.
Well, and for our American listeners who may have seen stories about Canada and Canadian healthcare on Fox or even CNN or MSNBC, I can change my doctor anytime I want to. If I want to make an appointment, I usually have a day or two or three wait maximum for an appointment. And for most surgeries, except during COVID, because like everywhere else, the healthcare system is massively overstretched, we get it with very short waiting lists, except on a few things. And the system is constantly working to cut those waiting lists down.
But I understand that like today, 100 people will die in line in Canada waiting for some sort of medical care. At least 100 a day, right?
No. The only reason that might be happening is there are certain parts of our country that are not being good about vaccines, and they're the ones that, you know, kind of tune into Fox News a lot, and they're overstretching their hospital system, and so there are waiting lines there. But no, it just really, in the normal course of things, doesn't happen. Now, I want to be honest. We have a healthcare system like any other in the world,
sure,
which means right. There are problems.
Yep,
they get addressed. They get fixed. You know, we all have, for example, the big demographic shift with a larger aging population. And that's a challenge for every healthcare system in the world, mm-hmm. whether public or private. But, you know, it's all mythology. I should say deliberate misinformation.
How is it that you even get Fox News up there? I mean, seriously. Aren't there laws that actually make it a crime to speak certain things that could cause the deaths of thousands of people? I mean, I know you don't necessarily have like a constitution with a First Amendment like we have we're so proud of it, but it seems like that there, I don't know, maybe I'm just maybe this is just my thinking that the Canadians have figured this out, how to not let lies become truth.
You know, it's a never-ending struggle. For example, we now have a Libertarian Party that ran in the most recent federal election,
yeah.
But it was wiped out. But, you know, you can get Fox through cable and satellite. You know, yeah. There was an attempt to start a Canadian equivalent of Fox, and it died a horrible death. No one wanted to watch it. So I think it's really the environment you grow up in, the general consensus about social norms and community spirit you have.
My guess is that Fox News being watched in Canada is essentially being watched for comedy purposes. That would be if I were Canadian, I would definitely turn on Fox News every now and then if I was ever feeling a little down in the dumps or whatever and just needed a good laugh. That half hour of Fox News would just have me falling out of my chair. So.
Well, we have a lot of Canadian comedians who can do their own takes on Fox News and probably do it better. So, right. Anyway, Michael,
yes.
I wanted to talk about your move to Substack. You know, yes. Tell me about your migration, why you did it, and for those of us who aren't in the know, just what is Substack anyway?
Substack is a free platform that has been put together by these two people. One is from New Zealand and one's from the Bay Area. Right there, you know, you've got your vacation planned. two great places to be. But they decided, wouldn't it be good if writers had their own platform? I mean, I don't want to say serious writers, but people who consider themselves writers. If writers had their own platform and they could write whatever they wanted to write. It didn't have to go through a middleman. It didn't have to go through any kind of censor or we must think about our sponsors. None of that. Just write. And what if then people who are readers had a site where they could read the writers and maybe some of the readers might be inspired to become writers? Because we all are essentially writers. If we are somewhat literate, we can write. And a lot of people don't think of themselves as that. And if they've tried, they got through the first paragraph maybe, and then either if it was on paper, just wadded it up and threw it away or hit the delete button on the computer, which is the worst thing to do because this is a cliche that I'm sure many people have heard, but that all writing is rewriting. The first thing you write is supposed to suck. It's mm-hmm. not going to be that good. That's why you have to write it 5, 10, 15 times. And now right away people are 15 times, but I try to tell people the sweet spot is when you get to 12 or 13, the 14th draft, it feels so good. It's so much fun. It's like, oh my God, I could not get this out of me 10 drafts ago. But this is what I'm trying to say. This, yes. And then Substack is like, it's not like, say, posting something on Facebook where all hell can break loose. Putting on Substack, it has attracted thoughtful people and people from all walks of life, of genders and races and income. And it's been such a pleasant place. I've only been there a little more than a month. You don't have to pay to read what I'm saying. I don't have to pay Substack. But we writers, we can do things like we have on NPR or PBS here in the U.S., where if you give us a little bit each month, like if you're a paid member,
right,
you don't get a tote bag, you don't get a coffee mug. I probably should give people a ball cap. But we have these little things. The main thing that all of us offer is that if you're a paid member, which is a couple bucks a month, $5 a month, whatever the writer decides, you get to make comments. Now, that may seem like, well, what do you mean? I can make comments on Twitter and all that. No. We want to create a place where we can have a civil conversation. And so what we have learned is that the haters and the people, the trolls, they will not give you $2 a month, $5 a month, or whatever, for the privilege to hate you. It's such an odd concept because we don't usually think about, oh, yeah, but I want everybody to read this. No, everybody reads all of my columns, all of my essays. Nothing's behind a paywall, except for the privilege of being able to comment and join in a debate with other people. But haters will not pay money for that. And it's cleaned it up like that. It's so refreshing to go on. I read comments. I never, like with Facebook, it's a rare day in hell that I will comment back on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Not with Substack. I read people's thoughts. I think, oh, that's a good idea. Never thought of that. Mm-hmm. I'll write back. Or somebody will have something twisted that I think, you know, is wrong. Plus, also, I'm able to do satire on Substack. In other words, I can make the ironic statement. I can be sarcastic. I can be sardonic. I can be any of a number of things that in the United States of America, and I don't think I have to explain this to Canadians, that we have a satirical illiteracy in this country. And if you've ever wondered why most Canadian, say, TV shows, especially humor, comedy, satirical shows, this hour is 22 minutes, yeah, et cetera. Yeah. Why are they not being played in the U.S.? It's because, sadly, half the country won't understand that you don't really mean what you're saying. You're saying it to make a point. You're using humor to make this larger point that you're supposed to get. You're supposed to understand that the person saying this, or the sketch that's being performed or whatever. And sadly, I don't know what happened. If it was like Christmas morning and I was told that I could take three things from Canada for the United States, just like a Canadian grab bag, the King of Canada says, America, you can have three of our things. Well, okay, first would be the healthcare. Secondly, would be the Kit Kat bar, which most Americans don't understand was invented in Canada, and the American Kit Kat does not taste like your Kit Kat. But now they've been bought out by Hershey or somebody.
Yeah, so terrible.
The Canadian Kit Kat probably sucks now. But the third thing would be an appreciation and the ability to speak in satire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how – you probably have the answer for this. How did Canada – and I should probably apologize in advance – for stealing some of your great comedians, because a lot of our great comedians are actually Canadians.
Oh, we share. They come back.
Well, that's yes. Okay. That's a kind way to look at it. But for Americans who are listening to this, whether it was John Candy or whether it's most of the SCTV people, the show everyone loves now, Eugene Levy and his family.
Yep, Schitt's Creek.
Schitt's Creek, you know, one comedian after another, all the way down to Lauren Green from Bonanza, who actually was not a comedian. It was not a comedy show.
But Bill Shatner is the greatest comedian of them all.
But actually, oh my God, you know, and that's the thing where I will play something of Bill Shatner's and to an American, why are you listening to this? I said, because it's so damn funny. And I don't think at first Shatner probably knew how funny it was. As he got older, I think he figured out, oh, wow, this really works. So I love him for it. But anyways, I wish we were more satirically literate, and then we would understand why many Canadians turn on Fox News for its comedy.
Right. Well, I think if I can hazard a guess, it comes from the being in the absurd situation of being a colony twice. We started off as a British colony. Right. And we had a chance to be the poor cousins of the, you know, aristocratic and rather toffee-nosed Brits. And then, of course, that empire ended. And now we're in many ways a colony of the United States. And it just gives you a different, slightly outsider, little guy looking at the big guy perspective. But I want to share with you a good anecdote that kind of illustrates that satire. And I think you'll get this. It's an SCTV. And we used to have, a lot of people don't know that the original SCTV, about 70% of it was just parody of stupid local TV in and around the Toronto area.
Right.
And we had a celebrity interviewer named Brian Linehan, who his shtick was being the best, most exhaustively researched person who ever did a celebrity interview. So you'd have, you know, people like, let's say, Burt Reynolds, and he'd basically say, I want to come back and come on your couch because you know more about me than I know about myself. You know, and it's like, who told you that about me? So they did a parody. Martin Short played Brock Linehan. It was simply just completely parodying the mannerisms of this interviewer, Brian Linehan.
Who was a real interviewer.
A real person.
TV personality in Canada.
Absolutely. We also had a very famous mentalist named Kreskin, who's still alive, very elderly now,
yes,
who would read people's
Kreskin
minds. So they did an episode which consisted of Brock Linehan interviews the amazing Kreskin, both played by Martin Short. And it consisted of, how did you know that? How did you know that? How did you know that? No, how did you know that? So anyway, that I think captures it for me in a nutshell.
Honey, why do they keep asking each other, how did you know that? I don't get this.
Yeah.
They pay people for this?
Yeah, exactly. Can't somebody go and tell them what they don't know?
I just think we'd be better off if we just see, because you mentioned the important point of satire is that it's comedy that punches up, not down.
Right.
It's comedy that essentially takes the piss out of those in power, whatever kind of power they may have. It may be political power. It may be corporate power. It may be the power that your husband thinks he has in the household. But whatever it is, it's a bit of the court gesture. The court jester. What would be a court gesture? I hereby swear to tell the truth, the whole truth.
Genuflecting.
No, but I think also, is this part of it too, and maybe this is just my own Irish background and some I've learned now from that Roots show on PBS, Scottish background, that the Irish and the Scottish lineage in Canada, that many people who are of that bring with them in their DNA the desire and the talent to just go after that which is up there, that which is hurting people, that which is whatever.
Right.
For some reason, why is it especially from the Maritimes, and there are so many people from the sort of Irish, Scottish background. Irish is the majority ancestry of this country, of the United States.
Absolutely.
Of all the ethnic groups, if I can call the Irish ethnic, we are, you know, at least 40 million of us have this Irish, you know, background. Who slapped the Irish out of us? You know, how did we Irish become, you know, we're never really in power. We only have our second Catholic president in our entire history. But we have so many bigots.
Well, I can only guess, but I think one of the differences is almost from the beginning, America had the melting pot ideal. Like, we're going to basically, you know, melt people down and forge an entirely new national identity, and everyone will be part of it. And in Canada, because we emerged from two very hierarchical European founders, and I'm not ignoring.
Don't leave the French out of this.
Well, no, but I don't want to leave the indigenous peoples, the many, many different indigenous peoples.
Well,
but they were.
You mean the people that were here?
The people who are here.
The people that were already here.
The people, who got trampled, stepped on, and oppressed. But the thing is, if you were.
I call it genocide in this country.
And here too. But if the dominant culture became the British. The class system was entrenched. So if you weren't British, you could never be British, and you could never be as good as the British. So you had to be whatever else you were, but within that hierarchy. So the sort of mosaic model was almost, I think, created because you couldn't aspire to be that which you were not. So people retained their distinctiveness. And then starting around the 50s with the post-war wave of, you know, European refugee and people seeking new opportunities in the aftermath of the Second World War, the idea of the mosaic as a positive, not just as a, you know, something we have to settle for, emerged. And now it's really embraced. I mean, we love the fact that there are so many cultures, so many languages. And if you're Irish, and especially I think Scottish has been really influential because it was part of the founding leadership. The idea that you've come from an environment where someone up there had their thumb on the back of your neck really makes you want to use the only tool you can to get even, and that is to basically take the piss out of them.
Yes, right. I've just found out about the Scottish part of me on that show with Henry Louis Gates.
So which kilt do you wear?
I haven't done that yet. But I'm looking forward to
it. You might end up being bikiltal.
Bikiltal, I could be. I'm open to anything right now, frankly. I've been in lockdown for so long. That chair over there looks good to me. But let me tell you, though, the Scottish part, he tells me this is actually my first ancestor in North America is my eighth great-grandfather in 1641. He arrives here, but not by his own accord. He was part of a rebel Scottish group that fought against Cromwell.
Oh, wow.
Lost. They were prisoners of war. And Cromwell, known for his great sense of humor, decided to took these 300 Scots and said, let's sell them to some of our plantation owners. This is just 20 years after the Mayflower.
Right.
Over in the New World. And so he got sold, put in chains, put on a ship, and brought over to Massachusetts. And Gates says to me, he said, you are the first guest I've had on this show who is white and can claim slave ancestry because they were sold into slavery. They were not called indentured servants. They were literally called slaves by Cromwell and his people and sold that way to these plantation owners. Now, the difference between the whites and the blacks who were slaves is that after, I think, 10 years, the white slaves could get their freedom. Of course, the black slaves could never get their freedom. And so He got his freedom after 10 years, got married, had kids, a family, some little outpost village in Massachusetts. And one day the native peoples decided, we're sick and tired of these people. They're friggin' nuisance. And so they attacked the village. And my eighth great grandfather was killed. And I said to Gates, yeah, but I'm certain he would have come out on the porch just before his demise to plead with the Indians to say, look, I did not come here to take your land. I was brought here in chains. Please, please. And then, of course,
exactly.
They're like, you know, shut up, white boy.
Bit of a language barrier in any event. Anyway, just back to Substack for a second. I mean, another,
that's sorry
okay.
About that.
Another factor, I assume, is your freedom from the tyranny of the algorithm and also from the corporate censorship.
Yes, none of that. And I've had to deal with that my whole career. And it used to be very difficult and annoying. And now I'm bored with it and I don't want to do it anymore. And so to be able to have this to where, when we say Substack, there's not like a director general of Substack that's going to tell me, you know, Mike, you really can't say what you just said. There's none of that. And so that is refreshing. It's only been 5 or 6 weeks. In a weird way, I think I'm a better writer for it because I don't have things looming.
Right.
Whether it's the need for the entity to make money, whether it's being told you know, we can't put that out there. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these are things I've literally had to go through on a quite a massive scale, not just a little phone call from some producer or whatever that says, you know, Mr. Murdoch would really appreciate it if you could just change up that thing. I remember when we were at my TV show, my series was on The Awful Truth, or I'm sorry, TV Nation was on Fox.
Yep.
Good Fox, not Fox News, what we call Simpsons Fox.
Simpsons Fox, yes.
And I got a call from the head of the network saying, Mr. Murdoch wants to know what this is, and he faxes it over to me. And it's an interview with the daily or the weekly paper of the United States Communist Party. And,
you know, like Weekly Worker or?
Yeah, something like that. I'll talk to anybody. Well, not anybody.
Yeah.
So he sends this thing to me, and it's a front page interview with me. And at the top, written in kind of large letters, is FYIRM. And Murdoch had read this and sent it to the head of the network who wanted to put me through some kind of, I don't know, inquisition about what are you doing talking to the communists. And I said, I think the real question in this phone call is, what is Rupert Murdoch doing reading the Daily Communist? Because that is something that I don't take it as if he's like trying, he's got his own NSA spy network to make sure all of his people that work for him are, you know, behaving. I want to know if he's actually getting something out of it. And that's why he's reading it.
Well, that's a good idea. I didn't really thought of that.
Yeah. Hey, Rupert, commies buy toilet paper too, so you can sell some of the commercials.
I don't know, but that's a little example. I mean, the larger examples of that. I wrote a book called Stupid White Men, and its publication date, in other words, the day it's in bookstores, was September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
And that morning, after the attacks happened, immediately, HarperCollins, which is a publishing house owned by Murdoch, called or sent some missive out to all the bookstores in the United States telling them they had to pull that book from their shelves now, today. And they called me and they said, no, don't worry. It's just, you know, this shouldn't be the pub date. And I said, no, of course I get that. And obviously, planes are going to be grounded now. We're not going to do a book tour right now. Fine. And they said, well, we'll get it back out there, you know, in another week or two when things, you know, kind of calm down. Well, a month or two went by, and they weren't putting it back in the bookstores. Mm-hmm. And then I said, can you come in and talk to us? I said, yeah. And I went there. My book agent went with me. And they said, you're going to have to rewrite a third, maybe even up to a half of this book. We've redlined it here of what needs to be rewritten. These are things you can't say any longer in post-9/11 America.
Oh, wow.
And I said, whoa, wait a minute. First of all, what is it? Post 9/11 America? Oh, does that have its own constitution?
Mm.
In other words, we've just rewritten everything. Have you redlined that too? What do you, that, you know, and I tried to use the old canard of well, you know what that means. The terrorists have won. if we can't put our books out or read our books. And they said, no, it's, we're not telling you what to write. We just, all this stuff about our president, Bush, and these things, it's first of all, the book's not going to sell, number one. Nobody wants to hear this now. And number two, you can find a better way to say some of these things that aren't so harsh because you wrote them pre-9/11. I said, well, my comments, and remember, this is before the wars, the Bush mm-hmm. wars. I said, these are actual comments based on things. how I feel about his politics and his policies and who he is. And I said, no, we can't put this out. You're going to have to rewrite this. I left that meeting. I couldn't believe it. My agent called them back and said, come on. They were like adamant. We went back and forth for almost another month on mm-hmm. this. I refused. I just said, no, I'm not doing it. I am not doing it. Well, we have 50,000 copies already printed, the ones that were in the bookstores. So you're saying you're not going to do it. Okay. So on, I remember exactly when this happened. On November 30th of 2001, at about 7 in the evening, my editor calls me from HarperCollins and says, we've decided to pulp the book.
Oh, my God.
And I said, what do you mean pulp? We're going to recycle the 50,000 copies we printed into paper so we can print other books. And I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. I said, you can't do that. And, well, we can. And we gave you a chance, mm-hmm. and you refused the chance. And so we're out of the Michael Moore business, and your book's not going to come out. You had a chance to fix it, and you didn't. The next day, I was supposed to speak at Rutgers University to a labor conference, and I went out there, and I did not want to go. I tried to figure out a way to get out of it, but I just thought, you know, it's Rutgers. It's New Jersey.
Yeah.
Have some respect. So I drive out there. I go up on the stage, and I say to the crowd, look, I was going to, you know, say a number of things about labor and unions today, but let me tell you what happened to me last night. I told about the phone call, and I said, I brought the book with me because I'm afraid no one's going to get to read this. And would you mind if I read a chapter or two to you? Because you may be the only people that get to hear these thoughts of mine.
Mm.
And they applauded. Yes, read the book, read from the book. And I did that. And then it was over and I left. Unbeknownst to me, there is a woman who is a librarian in a public library in a small town in New Jersey. She's there in the room. She goes back home and gets, now remember, this is 2001. There's no social media. There's no way yet for you and I and everybody else to communicate with each other without the middle man. And she goes on, but we did have listservs. Do you remember listservs? They still sort of, I think they still exist. But so she went on the librarian listserv that librarians would go to from around the country and told them, they're going to pulp Michael Moore's book. We've got to do something about this. Now, I don't know any of this is going on.
Right.
And a week later, I get a call from HarperCollins. And there's an angry voice on the other end of the line. And he says, what'd you tell the librarians? So, what? What did you tell the librarians? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know any librarians. You know, and why aren't you publishing my book? You know, well, there's 100 librarians out on Madison Avenue surrounding the building with picket signs telling us to free your book. And I said, wow, that's pretty cool. You're not behind this? No, I'm not. This is... I can't tell you. I don't know how this happened, but I feel like I should come over there and thank them. No, don't come over here. Anyways, but a reporter from Publishers Weekly saw it. A reporter from the New York Times saw it. And within days, boom, it's out there that what they're planning to do to my book. And the outcry from the public, from the press, from other authors, and with the message from other authors that, folks, those of us who are writers, we must never publish with Rupert Murdoch or HarperCollins.
Yep.
That's the death of a publishing house or any media entity, if that actually happened. And they got so afraid, they called us, my agent and I, back in and said, okay, fine, you win.
Right.
I'm thinking, wow, I've won something I didn't even know was going on. We're going to put the book out. We're going to put the book out here in about 6 weeks. And all we're going to do is put those 50,000 copies back in the bookstores. There will be no advertising budget. There will be no book tour. There will be not a dime spent on it. And we're not printing a single copy more of this book. Those 50,000, that's it. You're done. And if you think that you have a publishing career ahead of you, even though you're getting all this sympathy and support now, I can guarantee you that every other publishing house is saying to themselves, we don't really ever want to be in business with him because he is trouble. And that, so goodbye, good luck. And we left there. And I believe them, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, when it's sort of like the Ned Beatty at the head of the board table in Network telling Howard Beale that he has messed with the order of the universe.
Yep.
You! That's what it felt like to me, and I believed them. I believed that I was done and I'd never write another book. 6 weeks later, they put it in the bookstores. But because the story now has gone out across the whole country of them trying to pulp my book. Not burn it.
Right.
Just pulp it. And their promise never to print another copy. By Friday of that first week, the book was already in its ninth printing. Those 50,000 went the first day, and then it was 100,000 the next day, and it was insane. The book stayed on the New York Times bestseller list, I think, for close to 70 weeks, over a year, and was the largest selling nonfiction hardcover of that year, and sold around the world somewhere close to some crazy number, like, you know, close to 6 million copies. Just a million just in the UK, a million just in Germany, and of course in the United States, I think well over 3 million. So it was a lesson to me, but it was a lesson I had learned actually a long time ago when I was in high school, and I did something. I gave a speech at a thing to point out how the Elks Club, you know, like the Kiwanis and the Rotary and all this, my dad had gone to join the Elks Club, and it had at the top of the form, now this is like 1970, it said Caucasians only. And so he turned around, he left, his buddies were joining, he wouldn't join because of that. And so I was at this thing in the state capitol in Michigan where I was asked to give a speech, and instead I gave a speech about the bigotry and the racism of this Elks Club, only letting white people in. It ended up on the CBS Evening News. It ended up, I think, in the Times, you know, across the country. This is, I'm only 16 or 17 years old, and I'm learning that if you tell the people what's going on, if you pull the curtain back, and if you're not afraid, because our brain is kind of wired to, oh, man, if I cause any trouble here, I'll never, well, at that point, I'll never get through high school. You know, they'll kick me out. Something bad will happen to me. We're all kind of wired to be very, very afraid. But I wasn't wired that way. And so thank you to the Scottish, the Irish, and my Canadian grandfather. So I gave the speech. It ended up on national news. And congressional hearings were called. How is it after the Civil Rights Act is passed? The Civil Rights Act was for public accommodations and things like that. Private clubs could still discriminate. Hearings were held. A new law was, all this stuff was passed to stop things like the Elks Club from prohibiting black people from being part of the club. All because I gave this little speech in Lansing, Michigan. And I'm like, so at 16, I'm like, wow, that's all it takes? 'Cause, you know, I just saw a poster that said, Elks Club contest, write a speech on the life of Abraham Lincoln. And I'm sponsored by the Elks Club. And my dad had just gone through this. I'm thinking, well, isn't that ironic that the people that won't let black people in are having a contest on the life of Abraham Lincoln? So I thought, I'm going to go write me a speech. Right. So I wrote this awful, but the judge of the speech, the speech teacher who was the judge, loved it so much. He voted for me to have the award, the prize. Yeah. And the head Elks Club person on the stage had to give me the award for writing the speech, attacking
them,
for it.
Right.
And he starts to hand it to me. To his credit, he still was going to give it to me.
Right.
I just turned to him and I said in my 16-year-old voice, I don't want your stinking prize. And I just walked off the stage. But the point was that sometimes, my friends, you need to only do just a little. It took me a half hour to write that speech.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 4 or 5 minutes to give it. And then I ran off that stage and, you know, probably went to look for a vending machine that had Ruffles potato chips in it or something that, you know, some cuisine that I was favoring at the time. But man, it was just such a great lesson at that age.
Right.
That, by speaking up, by not being afraid, change can happen. And it can happen sometimes with only one unknown, pimply-faced 16-year-old doing it.
Right.
So that's been the ongoing lesson, and we don't have the time to go into all the other times, but you brought up censorship.
Right.
Fahrenheit 9/11 was never supposed to have been seen by anybody. Michael Eisner, the head of the Disney company, this is, by the way, fact checkers for your show, it was a front-page story in the New York Times. Of how he did not want to offend Jeb Bush,
uh-huh.
the president's brother, governor of Florida, because they were seeking a huge tax break for Disney World down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main reason. I mean, because Eisner was a good Democrat, but when it came to Disney losing a huge tax break, they weren't going to release the film. And then that got out. Front page of the Times, Disney is censoring this film and will not let anybody see it. By telling, I think, Americans, Canadians, anybody, you can't read this.
Yep.
You can't watch this. Those in power saying this, there's no better way to guarantee people are going to demand and want to see it. And to this day, Fahrenheit 9/11 is still the largest grossing documentary of all time. Thank you to the Disney Corporation, Jeb Bush, W, and anybody else. Michael Eisner and Karl Rove was very much behind the scenes trying to stop Fahrenheit 9/11. I thank all of them. Never have a bad word to say about any of them because of the career they helped to give me.
Right. So the moral of the story is every Christmas you send Fox a greeting card that says, Dear Rupert, please oppress me all the way to the bank.
Well, no, I don't do that, but that I probably should on some level because I never had to scramble again because that film, see, this is how capitalism works. Who's the famous, who's the person that said the capitalist will sell you the rope to hang himself with? That by guaranteeing that my films do so well now and since that time, I have no problem getting a studio or a funder or whatever to make my films, not because they necessarily agree with me, but because it costs anywhere from, I mean, my budgets have been anywhere from $150,000 to maybe $5 or $6 million.
Mm-hmm.
But if they bring in, like worldwide, Fahrenheit is probably brought in all media, all countries, close to $500 million.
Wow.
Well, what capitalist company doesn't want to hear that? It just became like, I didn't have to write an outline. I didn't have to, it just became, what do you want to do for your next film?
Right.
Well, I was thinking of doing, we'll do it. Oh, wait a minute. I haven't told you what it is. No, we'll do it. So I've had kind of a lucky life as a result of being, belligerent, standing up for myself and doing it in such a way where when I'm told by those in power, you will never work again. And even when I believe them, somehow I didn't let that enter into the wiring service in my brain that said, you know, Mike, maybe you should just back down a little bit here.
Right.
You know, come on.
Right.
Just rewrite a little bit of it. They're not telling you what to write. You can write what you want to write. Just write it a little differently.
Yep.
That, now, I just, thank God I'm not wired that way. Boy, I don't know. I probably should lay on a couch and have somebody explain this to me.
Well, you know, obviously it's working, so you don't, it's like the centipede, you know, ask him how he manages to coordinate all those legs. He thinks about it and he can't do it anymore. So just go with it. Michael, I know that we're limited on time, but I was hoping to ask you a few questions about your early life and, you know, the influences that shaped you, and also about how you make your films.
Sure, go ask me anything. Yes.
You've actually been really forthcoming about your early life and your family history, but I'm really curious because I get this picture of you that seems a little bit contradictory. On the one hand, shy, a little insecure, at times a bit socially awkward, like we all were in our teens.
Yeah.
You know, a kid from a working class Irish Catholic background, you know, studied in a school with the nuns. You considered entering the priesthood. None of this says rebel, right? On the other hand, you had all the hallmarks. And you're a Michigander, which means you're naturally polite, like, you know, those of us a little farther north. On the other hand, yes, you know, you had also all the hallmarks of a young activist in the making. You weren't afraid to ask awkward questions, speak out of turn, risk disapproval from people in authority. You know, you had the chutzpah to become the youngest elected representative in the United States at the time when you ran for school board. Mm. You know, where did you get the guts to overcome that kind of natural inhibition?
That is an excellent question because I've spent a lifetime trying to figure that out, because I am a shy person. I know I don't say that out loud or publicly because people right now are going, oh, right. But it's, anybody who knows me, anybody in my family, they know that I am loath to, I'm a fairly quiet person. I think that if I look back on my life, I'll bet you I haven't asked somebody out, like on a date, go back to high school. Well, I didn't ask anybody out in high school. Couldn't do it. So the two dates I went on were the women asking me if I'd like to go to a movie or something. But right to this day, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, of being in this sort of lockdown situation that I've been in most of this last year and a half. And, you know, I'm single. I live alone. And I think, well, when this is over, I have got to start, for the first time in my life, like asking people out. And right away, maybe I just felt the flush coming in my face when I said that. So maybe you see the red.
Yeah.
In the Irish face here, Irish Scottish.
You're right.
That just the thought of doing that is so. I am essentially an introvert in that way on a personal level. There's just something about when I see things happening that are so atrocious in terms of what is being done to those who are what are called the have-nots, mm-hmm. the people that are struggling to get by, the people who are shot in the back because of the color of their skin by the police. Just go down the whole list of things. When these things happen, my first response, frankly, is to cry. It's a rare day that I will not have tears in my eyes just from reading the paper or watching the news, because I take it so personally. When that drone in Kabul kills the 10 members of that family, 7 of them children, I feel like I killed them. I actually internalize it that way, because that was done with my tax dollars. I pay my taxes. It was done by the people who work for me and the other 330 million of us. That means I did it. I actually process it that way. And people are listening to this or watching and thinking, Mike, don't be so hard on yourself. You didn't do it. Yes. But if I say nothing, if I do nothing, that means that I did participate in it. I am a participant in this murder.
Right.
And so I think, and I probably can thank my parents for that sort of thing. They did not like, you know, they didn't like bullies. They didn't like the bullies in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they encouraged me to, you know, because I was always a bigger kid. So I would stand in between the bully and the littler kid that the bully was hurting, to stop that at risk to myself. And with the understanding that no matter what the bully does to me, I will not hit the bully.
Right.
I'm not going to get into a fight. I'm not going to do the thing he's doing. I didn't think about it this clearly, but now when looking, I knew that I would not lower myself to his level.
Right.
And be a violent person to respond to what I see happening. So I think that that was in me for, is still within me, that I feel that sense of responsibility. And when things happen in the name of the United States of America, I have to get busy and do something about this, because I won't stand by. And you brought up, you know, I wanted to be a priest. You know, I asked my parents in eighth grade if I could leave home for next year, in ninth grade, to go to a seminary to study to be a priest. And I convinced them to let me do that. So I was out of the house at 14 years old. And something I remember thinking at the time, and I'd like to credit Jesse Jackson for this, because I think this is where I heard this. Somewhere on TV, he was preaching a sermon or whatever, and he said, you know, one day one of the apostles said to Jesus, hey, you know, we're the apostles. You know, we're like, we're your posse here. Mm-hmm. So you can tell us, what's the secret to getting into heaven? We won't tell anybody else. Just tell us. And Jesus said, okay, you're right. You wander all around the country with me. That's the least I can do for you. So here's the secret code when you get up to the pearly gates. He said, when you were alive back on earth, when I was hungry, if you fed me, when I was homeless and you put a roof over my head, when I was in prison, you came to visit me. When I was sick, you made sure that I was healed. Jesus said, if you did any of this, especially for those who had nothing, then that means you did it for me. And Peter, I'm putting you with a clipboard at the pearly gates. You're going to check this off. Just ask them, did they help the hungry? Did they help the sick? Did they help those who were mass incarcerated? If you did that, open the doors. Come on in.
Right.
If you didn't do any of that, if you lived your life ignoring those who were the least among us, you have to turn around. And I forgot how Jesse Jackson put it. I didn't think he wanted to say you had to go to hell.
Right, right.
But at least you had to turn around and go to the back of the line and wait. I guess that was called purgatory. Or waiting in the restroom line at the old Maple Leaf Gardens.
Right.
By the way, when I had the show, you know, my show, TV Nation, became The Awful Truth. And the reason that existed was because of your good people in Nova Scotia, up in Halifax, who produced this hour of his 22 minutes. Mm-hmm. They said they would put up the money for my second TV series. And in the middle of doing that series, the tragedy at Columbine happened. And I met with the head person there and asked him, would they be willing to finance a film about guns in America? And I don't think it was 3 minutes later where he just said, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, wow, that's it? Yes, because we don't understand this, we Canadians. I said, I know, because it's not like you're that far away. And it's not like you watch the same violent movies, your kids watch violent TV shows, video games. It's not like you have the same 23 chromosomes in your cells mm-hmm. that we have. You're not better.
Last time we checked.
Yeah. Right, that's right. So why? That's a very, you know, that will be one of my questions. I'm going to come to Canada in the movie and find out why you're so different, why you don't kill hundreds of each other every day. And just to skip ahead, I didn't mean to get onto this, but when we went, you have this thing called Canada Statistics, this office.
Yeah,
is it still called that?
Statistics Canada.
Canada. I'm sorry, I said it the French way. Statistics Canada. And so we did this research, and we found out that you, Canadians, actually have per capita, per household, if you want to average it out, you have about, at that time when I made the movie, about 7 million gun owners. And it turned out that more people in Canada hunt than play hockey. Actual hockey players now. Not people who throw beer on the ice. I mean, I'm talking about real players. And that per capita, that was more guns per household than in the United States. So how is it that you have more of the ability to kill each other on a mass scale every day, and you choose not to do it, when all the cultural influences on your children and everything are the same as they are on the American kids? What was the difference? And that was a turning point for us while making the film, because we just thought, all we need is a few more gun laws like the Canadians have. and we'll be better. No, it turned out there was something actually about us that no law probably was going to fix unless we decided to fix who we were. And so that became, that was a turning point there in Ottawa of just seeing this through a different lens.
Mm-hmm.
And coming at this with why?
Yep.
And why Canada? Because you're Canadians. You know, it's not like you're not a nation of 35 million Mother Teresa's. I mean, no offense.
No. We got lots of warts.
You have a history, and your national sport. Thank you for letting us steal that, by the way. Has violence on a scale that no other sport would ever allow this kind of violence.
Mm-hmm.
That's Canadian. But, you know, somebody told me this here many months ago, and I don't know if this is true, so you can clear this up for me. You know, it's very hard to get a gun in Canada, as you know. Very hard to get a handgun.
Mm-hmm.
Not so hard to get a hunting thing, but there are rules. But with a handgun, it's virtually impossible. I mean, you have to really have a reason. And then you have to they give you a form that you have to get filled out. This is what I was told.
Yeah.
I want to believe this is true because it's such a good idea and it's so Canadian. And I thought, boy, this would be a great sketch I could write for my friends up in Halifax. But on the form, the guy who wants to get the gun has to get his wife, ex-wife, girlfriend, ex-girlfriend. They have to sign off saying he is not a violent person. It's safe to give him a gun, and they have to sign off on it. And I thought, what a genius idea if guys couldn't get guns because the women in their lives knew that they should not possess a gun. And I thought, what a great sketch that would be where, you know, I'll play the guy.
Yeah.
I'll play the husband or the ex-husband. And he's called all his ex-wives, girlfriends, whatever, into the living room that night and says, okay, now listen. I need to get a gun, but I can't. They won't give it to me, these Canadians. They won't give it to me unless you all sign off and say I can have a goddamn gun.
Right.
And then they're like, no freaking way are we going to sign that piece of paper.
Yeah.
And one by one, they refuse. They all refuse to sign the form. And finally, he just stands up and he says, damn it. If you don't sign this form, I'm going to shoot every single one of you. Just as soon as I get a gun.
Well, I could see it.
Have you heard this? Have you heard that this rule exists?
Because
it just sounds so Canadian.
It is very Canadian. I have to tell you that I don't know because I've never filled out that form. Because I think for a lot of my fellow countrymen, the first question is, why would I want a gun? I have much more use for a back scratcher. You know, why would you want a gun,
right?
You know?
If you're afraid of burglars, get a dog.
Yeah,
just the sound of the dog will scare an intruder away.
Yeah, I've never felt physically threatened. Why would I want something whose sole purpose is to hurt other people? Anyway, listen. Let's get back to.
Sorry about that.
No. I love these detours because they're very. They really say a lot about you and you know what went to make you the person you are. And you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about your school board experience because it sounded like that was another run-in with like irrational and corrupt authority. And ultimately, you paid the price, but you didn't back down, which was great. But actually, let me pass on that and talk about something that I think a lot of people don't have that much of an insight into about you, which is before you left Flint, there's about a decade of your life in which you're a newspaper editor. You also had a radio show and you were of the muckraking variety. You had the Flint voice, which later became the Michigan voice. And I think, was it Radio Free Flint?
Radio Free. It was my radio show.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what should we know about what you did when you were in the newspaper biz?
Well, I remember writing my first investigative piece about police killing black people. And the year was, I think, 1977 or 1978. So I wrote about that all through my newspaper part of my life. Some of these things that we're dealing with today, I have been dealing with them and trying to deal with them for decades now. 40 years plus of it. So in this sort of way of, and I tried to warn the people of Flint that General Motors was going to leave. They were not going to stay. All the signs were there. I mean, I didn't have a crystal ball. It was, they were moving jobs to Mexico, to third world countries where they could exploit people. And this isn't going to continue. Plus, you know, somebody at General Motors should just take a drive around the block in a Honda. They would see instantly what they needed to do.
Yep.
But they believed in planned obsolescence. They believed that the car should break down and not drive much more after 3 or 4 years. The Japanese believed the car should last at least 10 years. And Americans would go, why? How do you make any money doing that? The reason they make the money, and anybody who is who started at my age driving a Honda or a Toyota or whatever, you became a Honda driver for life.
Absolutely.
Because those first 10 years, you never went to the auto shop for anything other than change of tires, change of brake pads, you know, the basics.
Yep, oil.
Oil change, filter. To drive, and this is not a commercial for Honda or any of the other, because, I mean, I know the Americans have tried to do better now. It's not like it was in the old days, but, you know, and then NAFTA happened, and then that just killed Flint and Detroit, and it was... They moved factories to Ontario.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're moving them out too now.
Well, yes, but I remember at the time, the reason they gave and the irony of it and the pain of it was they had figured out that to pay for the union health insurance in American factories, the cost per car was something like, it was thousands of dollars.
Oh, absolutely.
Per car.
Yeah, I mean, national health care is a gigantic competitive advantage.
They gave that reason. General Motors and the others, we're going to Canada because we can make the car cheaper because the people take care of themselves when it comes to their health insurance and their health care, the government of the people. Americans did not understand this. And it's probably the first time most Americans, at least say in a place like Michigan, I shouldn't say Michigan because we all in Michigan go to Canada so much, you could drink earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, then, you know, you could in the U.S., that we had heard enough, we knew enough Canadians. That statistic during the pandemic, how many thousands of nurses in southern Ontario worked in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Not just during the pandemic, but before that. I mean, they drive across the bridge or the tunnel. And so we all know Canadians. Some of us marry Canadians. And I'm on the show there that our friends from Halifax help produce. We had this contest. We asked Canadians who would be willing to marry Americans because they're in desperate need of health insurance. And so we had actual Canadians willing to get married to Americans so they could, and we had this contest and they would have to, the American guy would have to really make himself presentable to the Canadian woman to convince her to marry him.
Did matrimony result?
There were a couple actually that, yes. and then we got told by the network that we were breaking some kind of law or something, some kind of immigration law or whatever. But I figured out pretty quickly that these were women that really, they didn't want to marry any American men. They just wanted to help out and do a good thing. But it was funny just watching an American guy trying to answer questions from a Canadian woman. And it's like, oh, she's never going to go for this. This is going to be a huge failure. But out of mercy.
Yep.
And pity, these Canadian women stepped forward to help Americans who needed health care.
Right. Would you take, ladies, would you take a Republican?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, don't do that. No, no. See, things have changed since we had that TV show. I would strongly encourage you not to do that. In fact, I was just thinking the other day of this idea. The reason why we've got 80 million people not vaccinated and largely pushed by the Trumpsters is because we, the liberals, the left, or whatever, are telling them they have to get vaccinated. What if we just admit to them that this has all been a big ruse on our part to get rid of them? That we knew that if we said, you've got to get vaccinated, that you would instantly oppose it, and you wouldn't get vaccinated, and you would get very sick, or sadly, not so sadly, sadly,
yeah,
die.
Yeah.
And that was been our plan all along. And we just need to come clean now and tell you the only reason we've been pushing this vaccine thing is because we knew you wouldn't do it. And we knew there'd be less of you. And we would control the next, you know, 20 elections. It's so dark. I know it's so dark to even suggest this. But I am fed up. I am fed up with this right now. And no, Canadian women, do not marry American men. That should be your, if you are literally living in Windsor and you're on some kind of match.com date with a guy from Detroit or Flint, and your first question before you even go on the date has to be, who'd you vote for? And if they say Trump, you got to disconnect them right away. You've got to just wipe them off your profile or whatever it is that, I don't know how the dating thing works. Again, I probably should learn. Yep. No, this is, we've gone way beyond the pale here now, right? Don't you agree?
We have a bit of that here too. And I do think
you
that
do have a bit of
we
it.
Do have a bit of it. And it's worrying because, you know, these things can grow. Once I think it gets mixed up with people who are better than you, smarter than you, better educated, the experts telling you what you have to do, there is a certain group of people, and I think it's largely people who have felt like they've been talked down to for most of their lives, who just say, whatever you say, I don't want to hear it. I do the opposite. So, I mean, if we really wanted to sort of go with your story, you create a secret leaked tweet or online communication that says, the plan is working. We're going to win the midterms because of the decimation of Republican populations. Then we can stack the Supreme Court. Then we can, and you go down the list of things that Republicans hate. And you say,
right,
all we need to do now is just make sure that we keep telling them to get vaccinated because they won't. And then, rest is history. And yes, it is dark. So we'll probably get censored for this. But anyway, let's move on.
Yeah, because actually one of the bigotry toward French Canadians for the Quebec, a leaked memo from this hour is 22 minutes. Is it still 22 minutes or are they up to 23?
No, I think they still have the same number of commercials.
Okay. So a leaked memo from the Québécois, the party that wants the independence, they're the ones behind the Canadian vaccine.
Right.
And so this will take care of all the bigots, people who don't like Quebec. No, we're not suggesting this. You're right. They you do have a certain decorum with your situation here. None of what we just said is going to probably
appear. Well, I also think that, just to get back to the part, look, there are people who don't really respond to reason. They're angry. They hate people. We can't really do anything. But there are people who legitimately, because they have been, do resent being talked down to because they're not as rich. They didn't go to an Ivy League school, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, the first thing to do is to put the superiority to one side and just have a conversation. We have a lot of doctors here who are having those conversations with people who are reluctant to say, well, tell me why you feel that way. Let me explain what we know about this virus, what we don't know about this virus. I can't take you into a hospital ICU because it's not safe. But, here's what I have seen with my own eyes. And I think that it's so easy. We live in such a censorious environment now on both sides of the spectrum, right? I mean, the left is not immune to this.
Right.
If you recognize that even if you're really, really upset at what people say and do, whether you like it or not, they're still human beings, try to find that bit of respect. And I know you do this. I know that one of the things that you do in your film is sometimes the people you speak to inadvertently humiliate themselves, but you never go out to make them look stupid.
No, I want them to actually come along. I want them to see that, hey, it's better to live with peace and understanding and kindness and love and all of that. And I have this, I probably have too optimistic of an attitude that we can bring them along, so I do give it my best shot. And again, as we said at the beginning, when we were talking about satire, to punch down on people who are simply ignorant of the facts. Somewhere they fell off the train, the education train, and they don't know why this is. And the fact that they hate science now, I'm constantly thinking about how can we fix that?
Well, I mean, making the public education system better, giving a more honest account of history would help, and better science education. And those subjects that actually lead to independent critical thinking, starting with things like English literature, history of ideas. They don't teach philosophy in most public or high schools, but a little touch of it might not be a bad idea.
No, yeah. That's gone. Civics is gone in a lot of high schools. They don't teach civics anymore. There was, I read a report, they listed the 30 universities in the U.S. where you can get an English degree, English lit degree, and never have to take a single Shakespeare class. Whoa! Are you kidding me? This is how low we've sunk.
And I know you spent a big piece of your seminary year with Romeo and Juliet. So, you know, I know that you've spent a lot.
which is odd. You know, we're in a seminary, and this priest who taught English said, "We're going to spend the whole quarter, these whole 9 weeks, we're going to spend this breaking down and taking apart the play Romeo and Juliet, so you can see how Shakespeare, how his plays work." It was the most. One of the really best things in high school that I learned, because I was able to enjoy Shakespeare all of my life simply because I understood the language of it. I understood the cadence and the way that plot would work and all the stuff that Shakespeare did because of that ninth grade Shakespeare class. So I am so grateful for the teachers I had and did have back in those days. I remember the day that the Kent State massacre happened back in May of 1970. I was in... 10th grade, and I was out of the seminary. I'd left for, you know, I read the rule book, and the hormones had kicked in by then, so I left. But so I was in public school. I was in government class, and I had out my notebook, and I wouldn't look up at the teacher. I wasn't listening to him. I was just doing this thing with, you know, with my notebook. And he came over. He said, "What are you doing? I've lost your attention. So what are you doing?" And I showed him, and what I was doing was I was putting a little gravestone, like crosses, essentially, a few Star of Davids. Wasn't enlightened enough at that age to know that there would be either no religion or Muslims or Buddhists or whoever. But so it was just page after page in the page in the notebook. Literally by that time, thousands of crosses. He says, "What, you're just how? When are you going to stop doing this?" I said, "Well, as of today, there are 39,000 whatever it was dead American dead in Vietnam." So I'm writing a cross for each one of them in this notebook. And I am listening to you, but I'm not going to stop doing this. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful to he didn't send me down to the principal. I'm grateful to him. I'm grateful to, you know, the creative writing teachers, all of that.
And I'm grateful that you didn't get the idea of doing the same thing for the Vietnamese dead, or you'd still be doing it.
Oh, my God. No, well, if you count Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Laotian, there are some statistics that put it close to 4 million people. Yes, I would be doing this still during your episode here.
Well,
you said looking up every now and then to answer a question. Yes.
I call time on that project. Anyway, I also understand that when you were doing the Michigan Voice, you had run-ins with a local corrupt police chief who tried many times to shut you down?
Yes.
So
yes.
That...
Well, one time was we got some leaked information that he was using federally funded employees of City Hall to go out and campaign for him for reelection.
Oh, and not good.
And, you know, that's just, not right. And so he found out that I had this leaked information, and we were putting it together, and we were taking it to the printer, or the printing plant, which was at another newspaper in Lapeer County. And he, so we took it, we dropped it off. They take 2-3 hours to print it, and then we come back and get it. I get a call as soon as I'm back to the office from the printing plant manager. He said, "The Flint police are here." This is not even in Flint. This is like 20 miles from Flint. "Flint police are here, and they have a thing signed by a judge. And they are taking the printing plates. They've stopped the presses, literally stopped the presses, and are taking the plates, the printing plates, off the presses. And we've printed about, 5,000 copies of the paper, and they're taking all the bundles of the papers that we've printed and putting them in this police van." Wow. And he had read the story that he was printing. He said, "They may be coming to your place next. You may want to hide whatever it is that you don't want them to know where you got this information." So we did. And I decided to be proactive, and I called the police. I called the Flint police. I said, "I've just heard what you did at the printing plant, and you're never going to get from us where we got this. You might as well give up now. And by the way, I am calling the press to tell them what you just did."
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And it started in Michigan, but again, by the next day, CBS News flew in a crew from Chicago. They did a story. The Times did a story. And again, it led to a law being passed within a number of months due to our police raid, taking our paper, taking our printing plates, and a raid at that same month at a CBS affiliate in Boise, Idaho, where they had gone in to seize videotapes of a demonstration, and they wanted to find out, you know, who was there or whatever. And there had already been a Supreme Court case with the Stanford Daily, the daily paper at Stanford University, where they, again, the police come in, they wanted the tapes of who was at the demonstration. And the Supreme Court ruled that there's nothing that protected them from that, and they had to turn over the tapes.
Wow.
So before Jimmy Carter left office later that year, Congress had passed a law called the Newspaper Shield Act, where it prohibited police from entering or having search warrants in a newsroom, unless, say, there was a murderer hiding out in there or a hostage situation or something. You cannot go into a newspaper or a TV station in the United States of America and take tapes, papers, whatever. That got passed in part because of what happened to us, and because, again, it was in all the national press, and people were like, wow, well, of course they can do this to a little alternative newspaper in Flint, mm-hmm. Michigan, or a TV station in Boise. But that means you're next. If you're smart about how power and how authoritarianism works, you are next. If you don't have that attitude, you're in deep trouble, my friends, because history has borne this out. So that's, yes, that is what happened. We got our papers back. We ran more of them. We put them all over the state. And that was, there's more of that story, but we don't have time here. But I just think you brought it up, and I just thought, wow, I've been lucky to live this life, even though it has not been an easy one. Even though police will raid my office, corporate chieftains will stop my book or my film from being seen by the public, but only temporarily. Because I know I've got the millions, hundreds of millions, who think like I do, that we shouldn't be censored, that we should be able to publish our paper and make our movies. And I know right now we're going through a time where it feels like our democracy may be hanging on by a thread or two, but that's why we all have to be busy. We have to get active. I encourage wherever I'm speaking, and a lot of times now it's online, run for office. We have elections, midterms next year. You should run for school board. Run for city council. Don't sit back and say, well, that's for somebody else to do. You're in a democracy. Sometimes if I'm on a thing like what I'm doing here with you today, I'll be introduced as an activist. And I say, no, don't use that term, because I live in a democracy. So you don't need to say activist, because that implies activism. Because if we, the citizens, aren't active, there's no democracy. That's it. So by saying I'm an activist is just, you might as well just say I live in a democracy. It's not a perfect democracy. Certainly, having an electoral college and a filibuster are two examples right there that we don't really have the right to call ourselves a true and full democracy until we get rid of these two things and we stop the voter suppression amongst communities of color in the United
right.
States.
But on the other hand, I mean, one of the things that I associate very distinctively with America, going right back to the early days, is the town hall in the assembly hall or the church, where people get together and talk about what's going on in their community and the issues that, you know, and then they start to send petitions, you know, write to someone in power, you know, organize a, you know, an action. And that, I think, goes back right to the beginning. It's at the roots of the lead up to the revolution, especially in the New England states, I think. And I think that spirit still exists for a lot of Americans.
Yes, of course it does. Oh, no. Don't give up on us. Don't give up on us yet. Because I think, look, we got rid of Trump. The first time he, quote, won, he lost by, you know, what was it? How many? 3 million votes.
Yep.
Biden won by 10 to 11 million votes. So, you know, the majority of us are okay. You know, just made me think, I asked you at the beginning of this, if I could ask Canada for three things this Christmas, what I would like. And so I stated those three things, from the healthcare to your sense of satire to what was the third thing?
Kit Kats.
That I wanted.
You wanted Kit Kats.
Yes. Real. I want Canadian Kit Kats. Canadian Kit Kats.
You should really.
The old Canadian Kit Kats.
You should try the Coffee Crisps.
And I want Coffee Crisp.
Coffee Crisp. Absolutely.
We can't get any Coffee Crisp down here.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? So now I wanted to ask you, what would you like to take from the United States of America? Like, what gift could we give you or Canada that you actually do like or admire about us? And you privately will say amongst yourselves, you know, if only we fill in the blank, had this or were this way, like those crazy Americans, we actually would be better off,
right.
Maybe.
So
is there anything that comes to mind? And if there's nothing, I will not be offended.
No. There are things, but I'm going to have to speak personally. I can't speak for my countrymen, women, and
that's true.
And
yes.
Others of various.
I have been appointed to speak for the majority of Americans who believe that the Earth is not 6,000 years old.
Absolutely. So, and it's a little awkward because I'm in a position of, you know, at a charitable organization of having to be strictly nonpartisan. So let me just describe.
Sure. Okay, that's already two apologies, though.
All right.
As a Canadian, you're only allowed three. So
that's fine. Let me
establish those caveats.
Let me couch it that I saw among young people in the primaries of the last campaign a sense of grassroots movement that was very specifically issues focused. It wasn't about, you know, we don't like being mean to people and we think that, you know, it's a shame that, you know, there's such inequality. There were, you know, specific proposals about the, you know, climate and housing crisis and gentrification and healthcare and education. And it drew, well, hundreds of thousands of people. The rallies for a particular candidate were massive. And that level of engagement, which hopefully will not dissipate anytime soon and will find new ways to channel itself, I think give me an enormous amount of hope. And I would say the thing that we share that I'm hopeful about is we baby boomers are on our last legs, and all the things that we sort of sold out of our 1960s ideals for change to, you know, go to work for the man and get the house in the suburbs and basically keep our mouths shut and go along, that's coming to an end, and that we should be treated by younger people with a very healthy measure of disrespect for that.
Mm, I know.
So that's my feeling. Michael, this has been a really fabulous conversation. I feel that we've gotten to know you a lot better. Just the values that underlie a lot of your work. And for that, we're really grateful. But as I think you can see, we're coming up to time and we haven't talked about your films. And I have to do that because this is an arts podcast and that's great. Your art. So will you promise to do a part two episode with me as soon as we can find a hole in your schedule? Okay. And then, since you already have our number, you know so much about us. By the powers not vested in me by the Canadian Department of Citizenship, I hereby officially proclaim you a Canadian for a day. So you can you can punch that ticket anytime you like and come and
I'm gonna spend that whole day gathering as many Coffee Crisps as I can.
Oh, you get
to
them.
Bring back.
We'll send you a care package. We'll send you a care package.
I'm just telling you, I want Americans to just try this Coffee Crisp, and then I'm gonna say to them, see, that's the people that invented the healthcare that we need. You like that Coffee Crisp, you'll love their healthcare.
Absolutely.
Maybe that'll make that the slogan for the campaign. Well, thank you for saying that. I will do that. And this has been wonderful. For people that don't know, especially Americans, there was a great documentary that came out many years ago. And you're going to know the title of it better. Glenn Gould, 29 Pieces. What was the name of
it? It's 32 short films about Glenn Gould.
Okay, I shorted it by three. I'm sorry about
that. Okay.
It's not 29, it's 32. But a wonderful documentary, if you get a chance to see it. If you like not just art or music, but the creative process, all of that. It's a wonderful film to see. And if I can, if you don't mind, just if you could indulge me for 30 seconds.
Please.
Because whenever I get a chance, I have a microphone to speak to Canadians. I always feel a need to say the following. Don't become like us. I love my country. I'm I can give you a long list of what's great about being here, about being an American, and all that. But over the years, you have invented things and you've created things, all based on a principle of, you know, we should treat each other well. We should take care of each other. Even though we have our differences or whatever, we're all Canadians in that sense. And what that means, it has a value system attached to it. And in these last decades or two, I have watched you, Canada, the country, the people, get out a pair of scissors and snip away every now and then at your social safety net. Pull back. I hear Canadians talk about, you know, there should be some private health care. There should be, there, you know, the Americans have these. And bit by bit, you allow this to happen. And you think it's okay just a little bit. We can be a little bit like the Americans because the system will be better. We'll make more money. I implore you not to do that. Because the more you become like us, the more you take away your safety net, the more that you depend on our economic system that sadly now I believe is just built on greed and inequality. The more you do that, the more you will also become like us. And I really don't think you want that, because if you look at our level of poverty, the number of our children that are in poverty, and yes, you have this too, and all these, but take the problems you have and multiply it by a factor of 10 or 20. That's what you get when you don't take care of your people. That's what you get when you don't have the social safety net. I saw this statistic the other day that there's something like 40 million Americans that cannot read and write above a fifth grade level. That's because how we treat our teachers, not well. How we fund education, not as much as we used to. All the things that we've done to take away from what built this country in some ways to be a very good country, you've started to do some of those things, and I beseech you to stop it. Don't do that. Stay Canadian. Be Canadian. You act as a shining light to people like me, and there's millions of me in the United States, and I'm not trying to say, I know some Canadians, they'll write me and they'll go, Mike, you think a little bit too highly of us, mm-hmm. Okay? But that's okay. I don't mind that. That is the self-effacing nature of, that's one of the rules of being Canadian, is to be self-deprecating. But I know you have problems. You do have serious problems. And the things that have come out this year about your history, appalling. But you do a lot of things right. And I will often say to my fellow Americans, you know what we need to do? We just need to be a little more Canadian-like. Not Canadian. Right. You don't have to become Canadian.
No.
Just Canadian-like. And when you said that about Michigan, that you've noticed is one of the more polite states. You could say that about Minnesota, and you could say about Vermont. Actually, I just say, if the state touches Canada, with the exception of Idaho, generally you're going to find people there where some of that Canadianness has rubbed off on us. And I like that, and I like us to aspire to that. And we are friends, and we are neighbors, but you need to stay yourselves and uniquely take care of each other from that kind heart that so many of you have. Please, that's my final words and appeal to people in Canada who may be watching or listening to this.
Well, to that I can only say amen, brother, and we do need to keep having open and honest conversations facing the problems and the really dark spots in our history. But I am happy to say that we're at least talking openly and very frequently about it. And with especially the Indigenous people who have been so horrendously oppressed and affected by it. So, and I think the first thing to do is to start, you know, stop hiding from those truths so that you can begin then to take the actions. And again, it's the actions that count. So we have to do stuff. But anyway,
that's right.
Michael, it's been such a treat to have you. And we are going to talk about your films because that's the art So we've done a really nice but very long layup to that.
All right, we'll do that. And maybe I could tell you a story or two about, as a teenager, experiences of entering Canada and what my friends and I would do when we would go across the Blue Water Bridge there at Sarnia.
Absolutely.
To enter the country of Canada. It all sort of fed into eventually how I began to think about, damn, why don't we just steal some of this stuff from them? It's such a good idea. You know, I don't mean steal things. I just mean if they've got a good idea, let's just do the American thing. Take it from them. Don't ask for permission. Just take it from them. And after a few years, just say it was our idea. And you ask anybody who's a hockey lover in Phoenix, Arizona, they think hockey is from the United States of America.
Right. And just so you know, our national sport, I think, still is not hockey, but lacrosse. And it's a war game.
Yes.
So we're not as necessarily as nice as you thought.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. And curling can get very vicious.
Totally.
So, yes, sorry, didn't mean to leave out these other sports. It's not just hunting. It's not just killing Bambi up in Canada.
Right.
And it's not, of course, just hockey.
Michael, you've blown our anonymity, so if we make a film about you, it's going to be called The Man Who Knew Too Much About
Yes.
Us.
Yes, and somebody in Canada may decide we need to hear less of him. What can we do about that? Nonviolently.
Well, you know, that happens at the box office, and it hasn't happened yet.
Yes.
And I trust it won't anytime soon.
Thank you.
So, again, Michael, thank you. Until we meet again, à la prochaine.
Thank you so much. And my deep appreciation to you closing with that. Take care.
Well, friends, that was our conversation with Michael Moore. We'll keep our eyes open for the next big announcement from Michael Moore. It sounds like he's got a project in the works. And in the meantime, Rudrapriya, you have some information for our friends.
As you know, the Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to continue bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving generously by visiting our website, glenngould.ca. And if you're interested in keeping up with the Gould Standard podcast and more work from the Foundation, be sure to follow us across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at the Glenn Gould Foundation.
Perfectly said. Couldn't have done better myself. And speaking of doing better, we always try to bring new and better episodes to you. So please keep following the Gould Standard, and we'll look forward to meeting with you again under the neon piano sign for our next episode. Thank you, friends.